Thank you. Good morning, everybody, and thanks very much to the organizers. This has been a great 3 weeks that I've spent here, and this conference has been very interesting. I've learned a lot because I'm not a soft matter person. I'm a hard matter person. So what I'm going to talk about today is going to be very different than what we've heard for the last 3 days in this conference. I'm going to talk about partition domain methods where we couple atomistics to continuum, but for modeling crystalline solids. So a different application, and therefore sort of different issues that come up. This various people that I've been collaborating with, so put them all up at the beginning because I'll run out of time at the end otherwise. My collaborators on these methods are Elad Tadmore and Bill Curtin, and then of course the postdocs that worked with us, Dennis and Barouz and Leo and the guys in France. Well, these guys aren't postdocs, Laurent and Frederick. W.K. Kim is Elad's postdoc, and then a few people that have helped out with some of the discussions and things along the way, so I want to thank them, and of course the people who provide the cash. So I have three general areas that I'm going to talk about. I'm going to divide this up in about 3 10-minute sections, hopefully. First, I'm going to give you an overview of these methods. These methods have been developed by lots of different people over many years, and so I just want to give an overview of that. That'll be a lot of old news in some sense. Then I'll take a fairly recent work we did where we qualitatively and quantitatively compared a bunch of these methods. There's a lot of these methods in the literature, and we basically put 14 of them together in one place and compared their accuracy and efficiency. So that'll be the second part. And then finally, I'll talk about how we've extended these methods. We and other people have worked to extend these methods to finite temperature. I should say that these methods are kind of related in some ways to some things we saw a couple days ago, where people were looking at coupling CFD to MD to do fluid problems or to do soft matter, let's say. In those cases, they're always finite temperature, right? No, you can't really do anything with those kinds of systems unless you're doing MD. For solids, we can get away with doing lattice static zero temperature calculations for a lot of phenomena. So we focused on that for a lot of years, but we're also interested in finite temperature, and some of the challenges that come up in going to finite temperature for these systems are different than some of the challenges that you face when you're doing a fluid system. So that's the three main areas, and as sort of motivation or starting point, we're interested, generally speaking, in the plasticity and fracture of crystalline solids. That's a sort of broad area that we're interested in. And these areas, one of the main things about this problem is that there's dislocations and they move long distances through the solids due to stress fields. Crystalline solids tend to have dislocations with relatively low resistance to motion. Lattice resistance is low, at least for the metals. And so because of this, these dislocations move long distances, and if you have things like cracks or indenters, as these two examples show, you have stress fields that decay rather slowly. So these dislocations want to move a long way. And so that introduces a challenge if we want to understand these things from an MD perspective or from a lattice statics perspective, because we need big systems to get the right boundary conditions on our problem in order to study the problems that we're looking at. So to do fully MD calculations are challenging. These aren't really large systems. There's sort of 2 million atoms down there and only a few hundred thousand atoms in the top simulation in these indentation simulations, but I just put them up as motivation. There's a couple things we should take away from these pictures as well. The first thing I want to emphasize is whenever we talk about these kinds of problems where we look at these dislocation structures that form in these deformations, the first thing we do is we make most of the atoms invisible. Because the only way we can see anything interesting is if we turn off most of the atoms. And that's because in these problems, less than 10% of the atoms in this fracture problem are doing anything interesting. Most of them are just providing an elastic medium to support the interesting atoms. And so we're doing a lot of extra effort when we do a fully MD simulation of some of these things. We'd like to be able to somehow replace those elastic atoms, if you like, with an elastic continuum or some other continuum mechanics. But the other problem is we don't know a priori how these dislocation structures are going to form. And you can see there's two different simulations here of a layer of nickel on top of copper. And the only thing that's different between these two simulations is the location of the indenter relative to a structure of misfit dislocations of that interface. And you see relatively different, qualitatively different dislocation structures that form. And then here the only difference is the temperature, but you see the final picture of the dislocations is very different. So we can't a priori predict where the dislocations will go, so we need the whole system in some sense, but we don't really want to calculate all those atoms because most of them aren't doing anything too exciting. So that's the motivation for these types of methods, and over the years, a lot of people have developed methods like this. This is a method that we started developing back at the end of the 90s, and we've done things since then, but that's the original, or one of the original references on this. And the idea is that, as I said, we're going to focus on lattice statics calculations for now, zero temperature calculations. If I want to do a fracture calculation like this one of a crystal, in principle, what I'd have to do if I was doing the fully atomistic calculation is I'd calculate the potential energy of the system by visiting every one of the atoms and adding an energy contribution to the total energy of the system, something like that. What exactly is an E alpha depends on whether I'm doing Tursov or Leonard Jones or EAM or whatever potential I might be using. What we're going to do in this case, though, is we're going to identify some region that we know we need the full atomistic description. In this case, maybe around the crack tip. We need to know all the details there so we can get the dislocations that form and the bond breaking that occurs when the crack advances. So we identify some region that we call the atomistic region, and we're going to include all of the atoms in that region explicitly in our energy description. But further away, we'll include only a subset of the atoms. We call these things representative atoms, or rep atoms for short. And then to facilitate carrying the deformation field and modeling the deformation field, we'll build a mesh over those rep atoms. So now these regions out here are finite elements. Each one of these elements contains some number of atoms that are not explicitly calculated in the problem. These green atoms aren't going to be explicitly tracked. If we want to find any of them, we can find them because the finite element method can includes an interpolation field, shape functions, that allow us to get the displacement at any point in the body if we so choose, just by knowing the displacements of the nodes. So if I have this triangle here, knowing the displacements of those three red nodes allows me to find the displacements inside there, and because the starting point is a perfect crystal, I can find the atoms if I want to, but I don't need to. Now the important thing is, how do we approximate this energy? And the way we do that is the atomistic region. So now this is a sum only over the atoms in this region that I called A, so that's just the atoms in here. So that's explicitly still an atomistic region, as you'd need. But outside here, we use an approximate continuum formulation, which is written sort of simply here, where I take the volume of each element and multiply it by a strain energy density that is a function of the deformation in that element. So if I know the displacement of the nodes on that element, I therefore know the displacement field in there. I can figure out the strain field, and from that, put that into this function, this W of F, to get the energy density in each element. So roughly speaking, that's how this goes. The last ingredient is, what do we use for this strain energy density function? I could use linear elasticity, I could use something else. What we use in the quasi-continuum method is, we also base the continuum constitutive law on atomistics, and we use something called the Cauchy-Born rule. So the Cauchy-Born rule is basically just this. It's a relatively simple idea, is that if I have one of these big elements that contains a bunch of atoms, the assumption is that when that element deforms, the lattice underneath it deforms in the same way. And so specifically in this case, I use just linear elements, then the strain field in there is uniform. There's a constant strain field. And so I can take one atom somewhere in the middle, this blue one, and I can just adapt or deform the lattice vectors of the Bravais lattice appropriately, given the deformation gradient F. And then with that deformed Bravais lattice, compute the energy of a single atom or a single unit cell in that crystal. So I can do a small atomistic calculation that gives me the energy per atom in this system. And then the assumption basically is that all of the atoms in this element have the same energy, and so I can get an energy density by just dividing by the unit cell volume, or the volume per atom. So that makes this continuum have a little bit more of the atomistic features. It has all of the nonlinearity, it's not just linear elasticity. It has the symmetries of the lattice built in automatically. Any phase transformations that want to happen could happen in principle, and that sort of thing. So that sort of completes the formulation of the quasi-continuum method. This energy that I wrote a second ago, I can just update a little bit here. I can replace this volume times strain energy density with a number of atoms times energy per atom, essentially, that comes from this Cauchy-Born rule. So that's, like I said, relatively old news, and we've been, that's the sort of starting point, and we've done a bunch of things with that. In the meantime, here's just an example of this problem here, this fracture problem. As I said, the goal is to somehow track the important deformation while keeping most of this thing linear elastic. And in this movie, you'll see the crack advance and the atomistic region adapt and follow the crack as it moves this way. So I didn't talk about the adaption algorithm, not really time, but you see the idea. These sort of blossoms that form here, this big red region, is the atomistic region that's grown to reflect the fact that dislocations have come out of the crack tip. And if I run the other movie, you can see the close-up of that. And occasionally, you'll see a dislocation pop off this crack. And that's why you see these adaptive regions behind the crack tip. So you get an idea of what we're trying to do here. we still have most of this region is linear elastic. And of course, this is a close-up. There's a much bigger region here. So most of this is still not linear elastic, but Cauchy-Born. So it's a much cheaper computation than the fully atomistic calculation. OK, so that's one of these types of methods. And since 1991, there's been many, tens at least, of these methods that are out there. And 1991, I had nothing to do with. This is the people that get credit for doing the first method like this are actually Peter Gumsch and his coworkers. I don't know if Peter's here right now, but Peter's at this conference. These guys in 91 developed something called the FEAT method, which is a very similar type of method to these, to the one I just described. But there's a lot of other people that have developed these methods. So recently what we did is try to look at all these methods on a single sort of unified framework and try to understand what are the key ingredients to these things. If you're going to build a method like this, what choices do you have to make? What do you put into the model? And so those choices, there's basically four. So the first thing is that these methods can either be what we call energy or force-based. And then in the example I just gave you, I discussed a energy-based method where we have a well-defined energy function. And that energy, if we're doing lattice statics, we're going to minimize that energy and get equilibrium structures. Other methods start from the forces. So instead of getting the forces as the derivative, but that should be a derivative of V, not a derivative of E, but anyways, the forces come from the derivative of the potential energy. Other methods just start from the forces, have some physically motivated description for the forces on the atoms and the forces on the finite element nodes, and then use that and drive those forces to zero if you're doing static calculations. So that's one key distinction between these different kinds of methods. And the coupling, in terms of the mechanical coupling, the force coupling, can either be what I call edge-to-edge or overlapping. Some people refer to it as a handshake region. The quasi-continuum method that I just described is what I call an edge-to-edge coupling. You have the atomistic region and the continuum region, and they're just butted up against each other. And that's illustrated here. It doesn't look like it's quite what I said because I've got these green atoms, but these green atoms are just what we call pad atoms. They serve to give the correct coordination to the atoms in the red region here. These guys have to see the proper neighbor environment or they'll think they're at a free surface. But other methods have an actual overlapping region, and that's what's illustrated here where I have the green atoms that are these pad atoms, but there's also a region where there's, I've colored them yellow, where the energy description there, or the force description, is a blending of the atomistic forces that come from these yellow atoms and the continuum forces that come from the finite elements that overlap them. So there can be a blending of the two methods in some kind of a linearly decaying weighting function, or there's various schemes there. So edge to edge is pretty unambiguous. There's sort of one choice there, but overlapping, there can be many different choices because it depends on how you define that overlapping region. Similarly, that's sort of the force coupling side of the problem. The other side is the compatibility or the kinematic coupling of the problem. How do you make sure the atomistic region and the continuum region stay glued together? And I use the term strong or weak compatibility there. Strong compatibility means that basically there's an exact one-to-one mapping at the interface. So, for example, here, these green atoms in the pad and these yellow atoms that define the edge are exactly glued to the finite elements. So the finite elements deform, those move along with them. And that's what I would call strong compatibility, enforcing the displacement across the interface. But some of these methods have what I call a weak compatibility formulation, where, say, these atoms here could be enforced to stay in these positions relative to the finite elements through some penalty function or some least squares averaging or other techniques. So again, it's not a binary choice. Strong is fairly unambiguous. There's only one thing you can do there. But there's many ways you can impose weak compatibility, different types of weighting functions and that sort of thing. And then finally, the Cauchy-Born example that I gave a minute ago was one example of a constitutive law in these finite elements. You could have many different constitutive laws, there, linear elasticity, whatever. So there's sort of these four key features. They're not binary choices, as I've said. But if you look in the literature, you'll find all the methods you can identify. Okay, this is how they did their compatibility, this is how they did their coupling, this is how they chose their constitutive law, and sort of build the model. So don't try to read these slides. I put these in because these PDFs will be available later if anyone's interested. We took the 14, I guess, most common, most popular, maybe most understandable methods we found in the literature, and we put them all together into one code. So there's 8 energy-based methods. 6 force-based methods, as I said. Don't try to read the details here. Here's all the references related to that. So if you're interested, you can look at that after the talk. But we took all those and we put them in one place. We put them all in the same code. Actually, we gave that code a name because you always have to. Multi for multiple methods and bench for benchmarking. And this code does all the it will calculate all those methods by turning on different switches. The code is not especially elegant or efficient, but we tried to be equally inefficient for everybody. So we tried to give these things fair, equal footing. And we took one simple test problem where we just build a block of aluminum and put two dislocations in it. Here's a typical mesh where you have an animistic region in the middle just with straight boundaries and then continuum regions on either side. And then we looked at the error and efficiency of all these different methods. So here's the error summary for the force-based methods. Each column is one method, whereas I go down the column, I'm increasing the size of this atomistic region. And then, of course, as we go along here, we see the different errors for the different methods. Blue is zero, so you want it all to be blue, so the closer you get to blue, the better. And we don't need to talk about the details of even what these different methods mean exactly. I just wanted to sort of show you that there's very different levels of error in the various approximations that you can make, even though these methods are ostensibly very similar. Similar result for the energy-based methods. I'll make one observation about the energy-based methods. You see in all of them, except for this last one over here, they all have these very straight lines. These are basically lines of error right along the interface between the atomistic and the continuum region. And this is something that's referred to as ghost forces in this literature. Basically, no matter how you build these energy-based methods, you always get a spurious force at the atomistic continuum interface. And that spurious force shows up in these error bands. You don't see that in the last column here because this is taking the quasi-continuum method and adding something called a ghost force correction, which is an approximate subtraction of those forces. But you know, very good estimate because it gets rid of the error almost completely. All these other methods don't have that force-based that ghost force correction, but it would be very easy to implement that ghost force correction in these methods. So it's one way where you can very easily gain some accuracy in any of these methods. Now, you wouldn't get rid of all the problems here, but you'd get rid of some of them. We also looked at efficiency just by, again, taking that one test problem and just comparing how long it took the full atomistic calculation compared to how long it took for these various methods. So it's only one test problem, so you could, of course, change the parameters and you would change the relative numbers here, but hopefully the ranking of these things would stay about the same and you get some ideas about what are sort of best practices. This is summarized in this chart. We don't need to spend too much time on it, but here's error along here and speed up factor along here, so you're sweet spot is down in the corner, so very subjectively defined some regions there of sort of high accuracy and efficiency, medium and low. And then some general conclusions that came from all that. So the first one is that generally speaking, the energy-based methods seem to be faster in terms of their convergence than the force-based methods. And since then, Mitch Luskin, who won't talk about it today, but has talked about it in the past, has done some careful analysis to show why that is, to show that the force-based methods have some inherent instabilities in them. For the methods that we looked at, the handshake methods, the methods that have these overlap, tend to be less efficient and less accurate. You'd think that the accuracy might be improved by the sort of gradual transition between the two regions, but it seems, at least for the ways they were done here, it lowered the accuracy and efficiency. Again, I should nod to Mitch, who's done some calculations since then of a different blending method, which seems to have improved accuracy. Methods that are alternating, iterative, these alternating Schwartz types techniques, specifically this one here, is one of those methods. They tend to be very slow, at least for these kinds of systems, so you're better off with a method that solves everything all at once. And then I mentioned already the fact that the ghost forces produce this error in all the energy-based methods, but it's a straightforward thing to correct, and I didn't talk about the details of how we correct them, but this ghost force correction is generally be a good idea in all the methods. All of the energy-based methods should include a ghost force correction. Okay, so that's a summary of these methods. That's a summary of the work we did to compare them. And then I'd like to spend the rest of my talk, which is about 10 minutes, on the question of finite temperature. And as I said, finite temperature methods for fluids guys, it's always finite temperature, but for us, finite temperature is a new thing. And I think the problems that come up are a little bit different possibly, and here's what we see as the issues when we try to study the solid state at finite temperature. I listed basically three things here that are the challenges in my mind. The first is that we have a very small atomistic region, and so thermostats, if we want to use them, are more intrusive. And I'll show you what I mean by that with this example. If I have an indentation problem, this is a fully atomistic simulation of indentation, and I'm using a thermostat to keep the temperature constant. Strictly speaking, I shouldn't be doing that at all, right? Because the thermostat is built on the assumption of an equilibrium system. And if I'm indenting it, it's not in equilibrium. But if we're indenting slowly, we can kind of comfort ourselves that we're not too far from equilibrium, right? And then what'll happen is there'll be, say, a dislocation that will form. And that dislocation, when it nucleates, it will create phonons and basically produce a little bit of heat right in here. But that's only a small group of atoms that are getting agitated here, so relatively speaking, that's not going to raise the temperature too much, and the thermostat will respond by tweaking the forces on all the atoms. Everybody will feel the pain a little bit, but that's going to be a relatively small damping effect overall. It shouldn't affect the overall dynamics of the system too much, and that's what you want from a thermostat. You don't want its forces to be unduly influencing the dynamics. But now, in these methods, our explicit goal is to make the atomistic region as small as possible. And so when I make a very small atomistic region, and that same thing happens, now suddenly, if I'm just thermostatting these atoms, then I'm thermostatting everybody much more aggressively to compensate for that heat than I had to do over here. And so now you're more concerned about whether or not you're still satisfying that close to equilibrium condition for the thermostat. Another sort of related issue is when we do these solid problems, we're worried about things like thermal stresses that build up, and if there's differences in temperature in different places, then we might be interested in getting things like thermal expansion correctly in this region. And you're not going to get that unless you somehow take into account the fact that I've lost all the entropy due to the atoms that have coarsened out, the fact that they have thermal fluctuations. I don't have that here anymore once I make these into elements, finite elements. So how do we deal with that? And then one of the big issues in this area is how do we deal with wave reflections? I already talked about how these phonons are going to be produced by, say, a dislocation event or something like that. These phonons in this picture are going to run right out to the edges of the crystal. They'll eventually get damped out if I have a thermostat especially, but they'll generally run the whole length of the crystal. But in this case, there's a boundary here. And that boundary, you can very easily make a little toy problem to convince yourself that boundary is problematic, because there's going to be short wavelength waves in those phonons. So they're going to be able to travel through this part of the lattice, to say fully atomistic part, but they won't be supportable in the coarsened lattice. And so if you just take a simple plane wave and hit the surface of that crystal, if it's a fully atomistic crystal, then the wave, of course, will just travel happily through, and there's no boundary there to slow it down. But if you compare that to what happens in just this relatively benign coarsening, one level of coarsening like that, you see the wave gets almost completely reflected off of the interface. So that is a problem because we have a very small atomistic region that we're going to trap the heat in. So you either have to thermostat that out, with the problem I mentioned earlier of the thermostat being perhaps too aggressive to not unduly influence the dynamics. So there's generally two classes of these finite temperature methods out there. I'm not going to really say anything about absorbing boundary condition methods except what I say right now in the next minute or so. I haven't written any of the details of how they work here, just pros and cons, but let me say something about the details. The basic idea of these absorbing boundary condition methods is you apply some trick at the interface, at the atomistic continuum interface, where you do something that essentially catches these waves as they come along and pulls the heat, sucks the heat out of the system. That might be through the form of essentially just a local thermostat, dashpots, or something that's an approximation to the generalized Langevin equation that essentially uses a time kernel to pull out these waves. So the details of that I'm not going into today, but the advantage of these methods is that they don't completely eliminate the wave reflection problem, but they mitigate the wave reflection problem. They can completely eliminate it for some idealized cases, but not for any practical problem. So you have to make an approximation to the exact elimination of these waves. But the other advantage here is that the dynamics in the atomistic region, deep in the atomistic region, are basically unfettered by this effect. There's no damping being applied to the atoms deep in the atomistic region. So the equation of motion there is just F equals ma, where F is just the real F from the potential. It's not the forces of the thermostat are not applied there. So that means I can do non-equilibrium MD in that region without any concerns. So that's the advantages here. The disadvantages, one is that if I do want to impose a temperature, it's not straightforward to do that. People have been working on that, but there's really no temperature control in these methods. And this is a one-way boundary in the sense that these waves arrive at the boundary and they're they get sucked out by this trick, and they're just thrown away. If you want to properly transmit the heat to the continuum method, then you have to build another layer on this problem, on this model. You have to add some kind of a fixed law heat transfer problem. So this is the disadvantage of these methods, and those are the advantages. The other approach is essentially a coarse-grained thermostat, a coarse-grained canonical ensemble, and that's what I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about. Here, we're just going to throw up our hands and say, we're just going to do this as a thermostat. We're going to assume these things are near equilibrium, so we're not going to really be able to model non-equilibrium problems. But we'll have full temperature control, and we'll at least approximately get the entropy of the coarsened region back into the problem. There's no direct control of the wave reflection problem, but it's going to be mitigated by the fact that I have a thermostat. So we'll be able to keep the effect of that down through the thermostat. So this is how we do that. We call this the hot QC method. We originally published something on this in 2005. This is the short paper, and then the immediate follow-up paper took 7 years. But we did finally get that submitted. Turned out to be a lot of details, and you're not going to appreciate them for the next 6 minutes, but you can talk to me about it if you want. Anyways, these are the details. This is some of the details. The picture is the same. We have the atomistic and continuum region, and we have these, in this case I've changed the notation slightly, we have the representative atoms with positions and momentums, superscript R, and the green atoms are the constrained atoms with superscript C with positions and momentum. And the idea is that we have the green atoms are going to have there's going to be some kind of a coarse scale motion of the system, the deformation, so say the long wavelength limit, and then there's going to be thermal fluctuations of all those green atoms. And we're going to assume that somehow we can separate those two things out, and the finite element mesh is going to carry not the instantaneous positions of all these atoms, but the mean position on the scale of the deformation. So the finite element mesh carries the mean positions, and then we imagine that each of these green atoms has on top of that a thermal fluctuation that we're going to somehow treat. And then the way we're going to do that is, what we'd like to do is basically something like, I've put here a potential of the mean force just to make some contact here, if people are familiar with that idea. It's the same idea here. We would like to have a potential that depends only on the representative atoms, the red atoms, and the temperature. And we do that ideally by essentially integrating out all the positional degrees of freedom of the coarsened atoms. If we could do this integral, then we'd have an exact solution. We can't do this integral because this V is a very complicated function. So we need to find some approximation to that. And I'm just going to put up the final answer, and I'll talk about each of the terms here and hopefully give you some idea about what we're doing here. So the way we do this, the way we deal with that integral is by introducing two approximations. The first is the Cauchy-Born rule I talked about earlier, and the second is the local harmonic approximation. So essentially the final answer that we get has, this is just the potential of the atomistic region, so nothing's changed there. That's just the EAM or Leonard Jones or whatever my potential is there. That's fine. Just for the atomistic region, just in region A. Of course, there's also a kinetic energy of those atoms, but that's just 1/2 mv². That's easy to deal with. And I also haven't talked about the kinetic energy of the coarse grain system. That's also relatively easy to deal with. It's just a matter of lumping the masses to the nodes, and I won't talk about those details. The second term in this equation is essentially the zero temperature part of the Cauchy-Born rule. So this is given an instantaneous position of the nodes, I can figure out the deformation in the element and compute for the mean positions of the atoms a contribution to the energy. That's the Cauchy-Born rule at zero temperature. And then there's this mess here. And this mess here basically is the solution to that integral I showed a second ago, but with some approximations. So this is the entropy part, or the thermal fluctuation part. And the key piece is this thing here, which is basically the determinant of the force constant matrix for all of the atoms that aren't explicitly calculated. All those green atoms, there's a big giant force constant matrix, and we get the determinant of that. Of course, we can't actually calculate that. So what it really is just the product of the diagonal terms. You basically, in this local harmonic approximation, throw away all the off-diagonal terms and just compute the determinant by multiplying the diagonal together, and that becomes a tractable calculation. And where this funny form comes from, just for those of you who are still following along at home, if you try to do this integral, of course, I said this is a complicated function, so you replace it with a harmonic approximation. And then you can work on this and to get it into a form where what appears there, the final result is basically the determinant of the force constant matrix. But as I said, the force constant matrix is too big to actually get the determinant for. If you diagonalize, you just take away all the off-diagonal terms, then basically have independent contributions from each atom, so you can deal with that. And then finally, because we make this Cauchy-Born approximation, we assume that all of the atoms in each element have the same force constant matrix. It's not the equilibrium, or it's not the perfect crystal force constant matrix. The force constant matrix is different in each element because it comes from the deformed lattice. So each element has a deformed lattice that has its own force constant matrix associated with it, and that's where the Cauchy-Born rule is combined with the harmonic approximation. So those are all the terms that you get. So now you should be able to hit my punchline button a little too quickly, but you should be able to take this potential energy, combine it with the kinetic energy that I just mentioned, and then just run dynamics, Hamiltonian dynamics, and this actually doesn't work very well, and this is part of the 7 years. This doesn't work very well because what you see is the properties you get are mesh dependent. And the reason for that, maybe after I say it, it'll seem obvious, but remember how we built this model. Oh, I'm out of time. Dang, I'm almost done. How we built this model is we assumed that the finite elements was carrying the deformation field, the mean deformation field, whereas the underneath that, the atoms are jiggling around. So that mean deformation field is essentially like another layer. I'm almost double counting the motion at the long wavelength limit. So there's an entropy associated with the mesh, and that entropy is essentially being added to the real entropy of the problem and creating this mesh dependence. And so we can correct that by again appealing to the local harmonic approximation and basically just subtracting off a correction for this mesh entropy, where the mesh entropy comes from the same analysis, except now instead of the determinant of the force constants of the atoms, I have the determinant of the stiffness matrix of the finite elements. So this correction gets rid of this mesh entropy problem. This graph is showing that mesh entropy problem. These lines all should be down here with the solid lines, but they're not because of this mesh entropy problem. When we correct it, it almost entirely goes away. There's a bit of a problem that persists here. And the reason for that is that this problem tends to be a bigger problem when the elements are very small. So when you have a very fine mesh like this, you can't completely get rid of it. But for the coarse mesh, which is really what we're more interested in, you can pretty much immediately completely eliminate this problem. And then we can do things like calculate elastic constants as a function of temperature. So this is for a nickel potential. So we get this pretty good agreement up to about, say, 700 Kelvin, which is about half the melting temperature. That's the various elastic constants. They're all kind of similar. That's the bulk modulus. And then we can do, say, real problems with this, where what we study first of all is indentation, looking at the effect of temperature on the indentation. So the force at which the first dislocation nucleates depends on temperature, and also the slope of these curves depends on temperature because of the softening with temperature of the elastic constants. So we did that calculation. And just an interesting final note is that if you take these forces as a function of temperature and you plot them here, they pretty much exactly fit this form, which is a Tomlinson model for friction. So it suggests that the lattice friction resisting dislocation nucleation basically follows the same law as friction on a surface. So there's an interesting analogy that can be made there, and perhaps we can learn some more about nucleation from that observation. But like I said, I'm out of time, but the chair is being very nice to me and just not mentioning it. So I'll just stop, because I knew I wouldn't have time to give any summary slides. I didn't make one. So thank you very much.
I have two questions about the temperature. In the first set, when you're at zero temperature but using a force method,
yeah,
are you just, I mean, the particles are now, you're pulling on it, so now some heat's being generated and then temperature should be rising. So how are you getting rid of that?
Sorry, you said?
When you say the first set, you're doing T equal to zero.
Yeah.
When you're pulling on it, you're generating, and particularly in the force method, the particles, the atoms in the atom region respond as if they're doing MD
right.
Or something. So
what I meant was we're doing quasi-static loading, and we're finding equilibrium configuration. So we would apply a little bit of load and we would let the system relax to, if it was an energy-based method, just minimize the energy for that particular load. And the force-based method, you basically have to drive all the forces to zero using some something like an energy minimization algorithm.
So essentially doing it infinitely slowly?
It's infinitely slow, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. And in the second, when you're doing temperature, these are metals, so there's electronic degrees of freedom, which means the temperature is not well described by the phonons that come out of just doing MD.
So that's why we use a thermostat. We can just pretend that that's the electronic heat sink. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, that's, thank you.
So I noticed that as the temperature went up, you got very good agreement until, what was it, 700K or something like that, and then you start to see deviations. So what's the source of those deviations?
The principal source of the deviation is the local harmonic approximation. In fact, I didn't, because I was rushing, because I always tend to rush, and he said, let me just go back since you're giving me an in here. Yeah, so if you look at these graphs here, the MD, the exact MD result is the big blue circle. So there's two solid lines here, but this is the MD result. And the squares, which I didn't talk about, are the best you could do. That's the local harmonic approximation. So you can't get any better than this line because we have the local harmonic approximation. So there's the main source of the deviations. And after we collapse it down here, they're essentially all in pretty good agreement with that. So what you're really seeing here is the effect of the local harmonic approximation. Could have answered that with three words, but I chose to use 20.
So just as a follow-up, people who've tried to do lattice dynamics calculations using systematic expansions around the harmonic approximation to higher orders tend to find that they don't converge very well for most systems when they start getting above, I don't know, 20-30% of the melting temperature. You've gone higher. Do you think that there's a difference in the sense that you're renormalizing about an expanded lattice or something? And have you looked back at some of the earlier work on these anharmonic expansions?
Yes, and I think that's exactly the point, is that because what we're doing is we're not doing a harmonic approximation around the reference lattice, we're doing it locally, we're always updating it for a deformed lattice, we get a slightly better agreement. I think that's exactly right. We're basically doing a harmonic approximation on a different zero point in every location.
Another issue that arises with the local harmonic approximation is you may not be at a minimum or a local minimum. You might be at a saddle point or something. Does that ever arise in your calculations?
It does. That term I didn't talk about at all, but there's sort of another term in the expansion that you can argue most of the time in our situation is small. But there's basically a force term, right? Because you're not at zero, you're on a uphill. There's a force term that comes out of that, and it's there. For our, we can miss ourselves if we're looking. It's not too big, but we kind of just don't look at it too carefully. Did that answer your question? Or?
Okay. You ever run into a saddle point?
Do you ever encounter a saddle point where? I'm not sure how it would show up in your calculation, but it might show up as a zero in your
I think
determinant
the key is we never go that far from equilibrium, so we're never at saddle points.
I have a much simpler question going back to the earlier part of your talk. You had this nice comparison of these 14 different methods.
Yeah.
And they had this benchmark problem of this aluminum cluster. And that was essentially a 2D calculation because it was 400 by 400 by 3 angstroms.
Yeah.
At least that's what it was written. So how much does this comparison suffer from the fact that you have essentially a 2D calculation?
Well, I think the key is you have to have at least two dimensions. I think a lot of people made conclusions about these methods based on 1D chains. And when you do that, a lot of artifacts kind of go away in the 1D chain. So doing the 2D was, I think, the minimum you need to get a reasonable comparison. I mean, obviously the rankings could change a bit, or the relative errors and speeds could change a bit, in more than a bit, probably, for different problems in 3D. But I think the key features we identified as the things that make it better and the things that make worse, I think that persists 2D and 3D. I don't think that two-dimensionality is hiding anything that we see in 3D. I could be wrong, because like I said, 1D definitely hides things, so maybe 2D hides things as well. As you said, obviously you appreciate it, maybe not everyone else did. It's not really a 2D calculation, it's 3D in the sense that it's a minimum periodic length out of plane. So it's 3D in terms of the atoms. But there could be some hiding trapdoors that I don't know about, that's true.
I found this classification you've done very interesting. Actually, I was thinking that perhaps this also could apply to the way we do liquids and fluids in classifying all the different methods. And speaking of which, so in fluids, we come to realize that we need this mesoscale approach also to couple the atomistic and continuum. This is not the case for you?
I guess it could be if we had more complicated systems in terms of the atomic species that are there, right? We're focusing mostly on crystals, which, I mean, what I studied here were all simple crystals, just aluminum, things like that. If we have something like that has two or three species, it's intermetallic or something, it's still relatively simple. So I think that the reason you need those things in the fluids is you have these complicated molecules that you have to coarsen out to beads in order to do some, in order to make some progress. It's not as important here, I don't think. But if I was going to do a solid polymer, then I would probably have to have that intermediate layer, I think. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. But to advertise for you, to some degree, CAD is a case where you have a mesoscopic description where you still keep the discrete dislocations. So that's sort of an intermediate between a pure continuum treatment of plasticity.
Are you giving me a chance to talk about CAD for the last minutes? I didn't talk about it because I didn't have time. As it is, I was over. But
that's the kind of sort of mesoscale construct that does arise in these systems.
And maybe the point is that the type of mesoscale construct needed is different. And the example that Mark gave is where we can coarsen the dislocations to something more approximate to an elastic defect and use those. And we have methods that do that as well.
So how much harder would it be to do a solid glass?
A solid glass?
With single, just simple atoms, but disordered.
I think it would be possible. We hadn't really thought about it too carefully. I mean, the key thing that would be difficult is the adaption, I think, because we depend on having the lattice to be able to find atoms when we need them. But I guess you could do that in some kind of a stochastic way as well. I need to adapt this region. I'm going to do it, but in a random way that is consistent with the correct distribution of the atoms in the glass. Something like that, I think.
But wouldn't you have to go there to truly 3D?
Probably, yeah. Well, and there are 3D. I mean, we have QC in 3D. I didn't show those results. But we have 3D QC. But then the adaption gets more painful. So there's... They're being dominated, are they?
but I do have a follow-up on this.
I mean, organizer's privilege.
We've done a lot of work on glasses, and there's been some nice work by the Lyon group with Jean-Louis Barat, who's unfortunately not here, and on Tanguy, and they've looked at the fluctuations in moduli as a function of size. And one of the problems with glasses is you get these very large order one fluctuations in the elastic moduli from local region to local region. Mm-hmm. And that really makes it very difficult because you have to somehow have your continuum theory has to have very large fluctuations, and you have to construct atomistic representations of that have the same fluctuation. So I think it's nicer to have crystals.
You know, I agree with that statement, but yeah, I think it could be done, but it sounds like people are working on it, so it's good. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.